The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're starting off today with the Oprah Insider section. Oprah kicks off Pride Month. And this article is by Oprah Winfrey. Hello, insiders. Can you believe it is June already? It's not just June, it's also Pride Month. And it was 35 years ago that my younger brother, Jeffrey Lee, died from AIDS. He was 29 years old. The year was 1989, and the world was an extremely cruel place, not just for people suffering from AIDS, but also for LGBTQ people in general. I often think if he'd lived, he'd be so amazed at how much the world has changed. There actually is gay marriage, and a Pride Month. How different his life might have been had he lived in these times, in a world that saw and appreciated him for who he was, rather than attempting to shame him for his sexuality. It was over 25 years doing the Oprah show that we filmed, I can't even tell you how many episodes, I guess I could if I actually went back and counted, affecting gay people. And I was always so shocked at the backlash we would get, whether from an angry audience member or the hate mail that people actually took the time and the trouble to write by hand, find a stamp, and send to me to scold me, to chastise me and challenge my beliefs and tell me they were never going to watch the show again. Well, I believe that every single person has the right to love who they want to love and be the person they most want to be. And my hope is for you, my insiders, is that you are living a life that lives authentic to you and that you have the support around you to do so, no matter your sexuality. And whether or not you're celebrating Pride this month or always, I wish for you the continued freedom to rise to your truest, highest expression of yourself as a human being. Because I know no matter gender, sexuality, identity, that's what we're all striving for, to become more of who you are. Have a blessed week, everybody, with pride. This next article comes from the book section. Know somebody in a toxic relationship? Read this. In her new book, The Age of Magical Overthinking, Amanda Montell opens up about the most irrational thing she's ever done in love, and how she finally saw the light. And this article is by Amanda Montell. This is a story about the most irrational thing I've ever done. It's also an attempt to make sense of it, even forgive it. Much has been written in the areas of psychology and self-help, seeking to explain the truly unhinged behavioral patterns humans exhibit in defense of their romantic relationships, including and especially the horrible ones. Partnerships can be pure misery, and still, many of us are practically allergic to ending them. By way of explanation, there's talk of trauma and cycles of abuse. There's talk of destroyed self-esteem and fear of retaliation. Then, among behavioral economists, there's talk of the sunk cost fallacy, the deeply ingrained conviction that spending resources you can't get back, money and time, but also emotional resources like secrets and hope, justifies spending even more. It is this explanation that jigsaw clicked into place what I was never able to understand about my choice to stay in a relationship that caused me great suffering for 7 of my formative years. I got to know the man 2 months after my 18th birthday and 2 months before graduation. The man, meaning my long-term ex, the older one, whose name I avoid mentioning if I can help it, I've tried coming up with code names for him, partially for his anonymity, but also because saying the real one still makes me queasy. My nerves remember the assortment of vowels and consonants, the stress they carried. A pseudonym tricks the body. A few years ago, I settled on the alias Mr. Backpack, partially because he was obsessed with hiking, but also because the label feels neutral and non-threatening, like a side character in a children's TV show. Symbolically, it also tracks because our relationship still weighs on my shoulders, and I look forward to the day I can finally take a load off, untie my boots, and have a chortle about the time I almost tripped and fell off an emotional cliff. Things kicked off with Mr. Backpack my senior year, right when my teenage hope for the future was at its peak ripeness. Prickly and awkward on the outside, but soft and bursting with sweetness within like a jackfruit. Still living with my parents, but so close to leaving for college in New York City, the big electric island where I'd always planned to spend my adulthood. I was starved for my life to start already. I wanted something righteously exciting to bump me from the standby list onto the next flight. The charismatic older man seemed like a pilot offering me a first-class seat. Mr. Backpack was 29, with an acerbic wit and steely eyes. He was my best friend's eldest sibling, so naturally I developed a crush. He had a sandpaper beard and a Scotch-Irish pale skin that bore more tattoos and scars than the baby-faced boys of my age. And those eyes, which crinkled when he told me I had something special to say to the world, and he'd be the one to help me figure it out. Our flirtation began over text, while I was gearing up for finals and he was working on a movie set in California where he lived. Even after the text messages developed into long, late-night phone calls, I never considered it could be anything other than an unlikely friendship. After all, why would a man nearing 30, with a job and a life 3,000 miles away, want anything more from someone whose greatest life accomplishment had to do with an AP exam? A few weeks in, Mr. Backpack announced on the phone that he was interested in me romantically. My guts plummeted. "Get in line," I joked, playing some version of cool. In reality, I was in my childhood basement, where I always took these clandestine calls, eyeing a sun-bleached 8x10 portrait of my grandparents, fully exiting my body. I'd never had a boyfriend before. "What are we doing here, Amanda?" he prompted. To save face, I pretended I had been in on our dalliance all along. Who was I to turn him down? For the next 3 years, instead of going out with college friends on weekends and recharging at home on semester breaks, I flew to Los Angeles to be with Mr. Backpack. Despite my mentor's advice against it, I graduated early so I could join him out there sooner. At the time, I was too starry-eyed to notice the red flags, like the way he spoke about his ex-girlfriends as if they were all malicious traitors. "I can't become just another ex," I told myself. Or when he warned me on our first trip together in 2010, a dwindling bottle of Jack Daniels in hand, that he was a very moody person and I should prepare for the next downswing. Or the rare visit he paid me in New York my sophomore year, when he stayed in my dorm room to save money and got so furious about having to sign in and out at the security desk whenever he went out for a smoke that he punched the elevator wall next to me until his fist bled. Our relationship was so abnormal under any such scrutiny all the time that I never spoke an ugly word about it, not even to my closest friends. This was partially out of loyalty to Mr. Backpack, but also because I was convinced that once I put my misadventures on the record, the story would change from one of an old soul's extraordinary love to a dumb kid's choice to tolerate abuse. I didn't want that to be my story. I don't think Mr. Backpack set out to harm anyone. I don't think he seriously considered our power dynamic at all. But after my move to Los Angeles, as I got older and more self-assured, the power scales shifted, and he got meaner. "Do you hear how stupid you sound?" were phrases to which I became so accustomed they turned to white noise. I told myself that pain came with the territory of a relationship like this, that I was lucky a wise older man had chosen me at all. And the longer I stayed, the more challenging things got, the more faith I placed in that notion. I felt compulsory. I was 25 before I finally defected. 4 years later, at 29, the very age that Mr. Backpack was when we started things, I finally decided to conduct a post-breakup autopsy. Information was control. I got in touch with a well-known clinical psychologist named Dr. Ramani Jervasula, author of several books, including Should I Stay or Should I Go? Surviving a Relationship with a Narcissist. Jervasula explained that choosing to charge past the wind farm of red flags and suffer for years in a bad relationship can be connected to an investment model. People might think, I've put in all this time and I don't want to look back in 20 years and think it was all for nothing, she told me. Textbook sunk cost fallacy. So here's me saying it, maybe to the void, maybe to you. It's never too late to cut your losses. At any time you can unload the heavy pack from your shoulders, leave it on the mountain, and turn back. Because the view you were promised isn't actually up there, and it's not worth the climb anymore. It's okay to forgive yourself. After all, everyone has their baggage, and to build a life that's so full and so yours that you never really sunk any costs at all. There's a book that accompanies this article, The Age of Magical Overthinking by Amanda Montell, and it's $20 at Amazon. Parts of this article were edited due to time. We're moving on to wellness. How to get the best night's sleep of your life. Here's how to optimize your Z's. This article is by Sophia Lodato. Whether you're 26 or 62, there's always something, or someone, that threatens a night of slumber. In fact, while the CDC says adults should be getting 7 to 9 hours of sleep each night, they note that at least one-third of us are falling short of that number. But that doesn't mean you're doomed to eternal exhaustion, or diabetes, high blood pressure, or heart disease, all conditions for which chronic sleep deficits can raise the risk. Here are some fail-safe tips to get a wonderful night's rest. Read 'em and sleep. Stick to a regular sleep schedule. This might seem obvious, but it's also the number one thing you can do to improve the quality and depth of your sleep. Why? It helps train your body's internal clock, making it easier to fall asleep and wake up naturally, says Shelby Harris, PSYD, a clinical associate professor of neurology at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City and the director of sleep health at Sleepopolis. She stresses how important it is to aim for a regular bedtime and wake-up time. Yes, even on the weekends, to regulate your circadian rhythm. Sleep positions matter. Sorry, stomach sleepers. It turns out that there are certain positions that are much better for your health. Sleeping on your front can often lead to strain in your neck and back, which will impede your ability to sleep soundly. Sleeping on your back comes most highly recommended because, according to Harris, it helps align your spine and reduces pressure on it. But sleeping on your side can also be good. It keeps your airways open, particularly helpful if you snore or have sleep apnea. Soothe yourself into slumber. Certain breathwork exercises can mitigate anxiety and even produce more of the sleep hormone melatonin. Harris also recommends a technique called progressive muscle relaxation. This is a process in which you intentionally tense, then relax each muscle group one by one. YouTube and Spotify have plenty of guided versions of this exercise. Harris advises trying your hand at several of these techniques in order to discover what works best for you, your body, and your evening routine. Create a cocoon. How can you build your very own sleep haven? First and foremost, Harris says, it's crucial to keep your bedroom on the cool side and to have breathable bedding, as your body temperature will naturally decrease when you sleep. And there's nothing worse than waking up in a hot sweat. Aside from making sure it's dark and quiet, keeping your electronics out of the bedroom is key. And if you can manage, try to use your bed only for three S's: sleep, sex, and sickness. Eat for deep Z's. Foods high in sugar or caffeine can interfere with your sleep, especially if you have them too close to bedtime, Harris says. Additionally, she recommends avoiding anything particularly heavy or spicy before bedtime, which can disturb your sleep with acid reflux or indigestion. That said, she notes that you could also try to encourage sleep by eating foods with the amino acid tryptophan, like turkey, magnesium, like spinach, or melatonin, like cherries, all of which can help you sleep better. Cut the evening cardio. While research shows that regular exercise improves sleep quality, when you do it is key. It's generally best to exercise earlier in the day, like in the morning or afternoon, because it can help regulate your sleep-wake cycle, Harris says. Exercising close to bedtime, especially if it's intense, can make it harder to fall asleep. But gentle activities like yoga in the evening can be relaxing and may help you sleep better. Don't obsess over your tracker. Smartwatches and sleep trackers monitor your sleep by tracking movement and heart rate. They can give you insights into your sleep patterns and help you understand how well you're sleeping, Harris explains, but whether they're worth it depends on your goals and how you use the data. While some may find all that data helpful, others might become too focused on these numbers, causing more sleep anxiety. There's even a term for this, orthosomnia, the compulsive checking of sleep devices. Research shows that certain athletes performed markedly worse, knowing that their pre-performance night sleep was not optimal, and that the monitoring of their sleep tracking devices may have adversely impacted their sense of self-efficacy and motivation. Consider a sleep divorce. Separate bedrooms might be a saving grace if you love a snorer or a blanket hogger. In fact, according to a survey by the American Association of Sleep Medicine, over a third of Americans have opted for sleeping separately, at least some of the time. Not to mention that plenty of celebrities, Cameron Diaz for one, are big fans. However, if you can't afford the luxury of a second bedroom, or can't bear to part with your partner each night, try the Scandinavian sleep method. Separate twin duvets help mitigate temperature and tugging on blankets. And if that's not your jam either, we recommend investing in high-quality earbuds or other sleep accessories to mitigate the noise. It might mean giving your bedtime routine an overhaul, but follow Harris's advice and you should soon be drifting off to the land of Nod. We're in the Lifetime Wholeness section next for this article. Death doula Alua Arthur shares the secret to dying well. As Arthur explains, reflecting on your mortality can bring you closer to living the life you want. This article is by Sophia Lodato. Is it possible to die well? Death doula Alua Arthur is no stranger to this question. In fact, she founded an entire organization, Going with Grace, dedicated to death doula training and end-of-life planning, with the intention to completely redefine the end-of-life experience. She has helped numerous people pass with grace. Arthur, who is the New York Times best-selling author of Briefly, Perfectly Human, has learned that mortality is a powerful tool. It should not feel frightening. Instead, it's something that can bring us closer to the life we desire, and it can teach us how to live with our full humanity. Arthur is opening up about her full story to Oprah Daily in a video above. Find out how she became a death doula, with helping others die has taught her about the value of life and her best secrets to dying well. There's a book that accompanies this article, Making an Authentic Life by Getting Real About the End, Briefly, Perfectly Human, by Alua, and that's spelled A-L-U-A, Arthur, A-R-T-H-U-R, and it's $22 at Amazon. Hey, we're over in Lifestyle, Women Who Start Things. An Academic Shroom Boom: How Ashley Walsh, founder and CEO of preclinical biotech company Interstate, is shaking up the world of psilocybin research to focus on female health. This article is by Rosie Hopegood. In the past few years, the use of psilocybin, the psychedelic substance found in magic mushrooms, has skyrocketed. Back in 2018, the FDA granted breakthrough research status to psilocybin as a treatment for depression. And last June, America's first licensed psilocybin service center opened in Oregon, with a waitlist that quickly stretched to thousands. So far, much of the research has focused on treating depression and PTSD. Psychedelics pioneer Ashley Walsh is changing the landscape of research in the field by exploring potential uses for a whole host of women's health issues. Walsh comes from a family of entrepreneurs. She and her father co-founded the successful liquor brand Chemo Sabe Mezcal, a better for your spirit that went public 2 months ago. Interstate is her first foray into the world of mushrooms and women's health. Where the idea came from. We currently have broken systems of healthcare in this country, and I wanted to be part of the change. For me, one of the change points was looking at psychedelics and recognizing that they are such a powerful force. I began researching the cultivation of psilocybin mushrooms, and I saw that there was a disjointed nature between what was happening in the wellness and science communities. Scientists are investigating a single molecule of psilocybin, synthesized through either a chemical or biological process, for use in a single indication, whether it be OCD or depression treatments. This is beautiful because it changed the hearts and minds of the community in our country. And it's really showing efficacious results. Meanwhile, the wellness community uses whole mushrooms as opposed to synthetic psilocybin, and this is what interested me. We don't have enough research about what I call fungi biotech, but it's an exciting field. It's looking at a molecular gold mine. This is where antibiotics and penicillin came from. The goal. I was intrigued by the treasure trove of potential healing and therapeutic uses to be unlocked. My vision was to partner with an esteemed academic community and get a Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, license to grow the whole mushroom, looking at all the potential novel molecules that haven't been found yet. I wanted to shift the conversation from the pharmaceutical approach to more holistic medicine. First steps. The first step was looking for a university who would be interested in partnering on a project like this. To me, it was vital that we do it on a federal level. It allows us to move toward FDA approval and even potentially shift policy. Ohio State University ended up having the perfect group of researchers, including a mycologist, Jason Slott, and Alan Davis, who was already doing work on psilocybin and PTSD. It was really the perfect synergy of everybody working to make this project happen. Hardest moments. There's a lot of bureaucracy around growing a Schedule I drug. The legal protocol for growing the mushrooms became very strenuous. We literally had to move them across campus in a lockbox, which doesn't work very well for natural products like mushrooms. The moment you thought this just might work. I get chills thinking about the moment I found out we had approval from the DEA. I was at a lunch, and I got the notice from Dr. Jason. I told the person in front of me, "I don't think I'm going to be good company right now. I'm too excited." The results. We are in the process of looking at different indications for women's health research. And we've probably got a month or two before we actually get the research in front of us. But what we're starting to see is a shift in the industry towards a focus on female health and wellness. There is much more interest in what we're doing, which wasn't necessarily there in the beginning. Next steps. The next step is really zeroing in on the therapeutic uses for women's health and endocrine tissues. We want to look at how mushrooms shift the hormonal issues we come up against in menopause, from brain fog to low sex drive. Then we want to move forward with securing better access. And this is such a critical part for me. If we can get insurance and the FDA behind us, we're going to be able to start healing the people who are really suffering. Our next article is in Relationships. One man's recipe for lasting love. After decades of marriage, the author of the Oprah's book club pick Midwives and the new novel The Princess of Las Vegas shares his romantic secrets. This article is by Chris Bohajalian. A few years ago, before the pandemic, I was in Las Vegas for a panel about why we sometimes root for villains in fiction. When my work was done, I looked at my wife and said, "Okay, now what?" Neither of us gambles, neither of us shops. She shrugged and said, "Get married again?" It was a joke, but the sort with legs, because we were in Las Vegas. Also, I had been calling her my lovely bride without a touch of irony for years. So we spent the afternoon in Ubers visiting chapels on the Strip. We saw the Bellagio, for instance, which had two chapels, a terrace, and a courtyard with a fountain. They could handle up to 80 guests. "Well, we have three," my wife told the woman there, and that included the two of us and a friend of ours who was also in town. As we were leaving, she whispered to me, "We're thinking too high end." Years ago, on an earlier trip to Vegas, my wife, a photographer, had taken lots of photos off the Strip, including wedding chapels. She recalled one she'd liked because of the modesty of its name, a little white chapel, not the Little White Chapel, a Little White Chapel, downright humble, which is perhaps the antithesis of Las Vegas. So we went there next. It was bigger than we remembered, and the renewal packages included flowers and boutonnieres and a certificate suitable for framing, because who doesn't frame their wedding renewal certificate? We told the wedding planner that we wanted Elvis to officiate. The planner said, sure, we could do that, but if we wanted a really good Elvis, we should consider returning at 10 p.m., when her favorite Elvis was available. This was fine with us, because Vegas is, by design, a world without clocks. We were back at the appointed time, and the chapel attendant gave my wife a bouquet of antique ivory roses. And then we met our hunk of burning love, our Elvis. The guy never once broke character. He sang, "Love Me Tender," as he escorted my wife down the aisle. Trust me, everyone on this planet should get to watch the love of their lives walked down the aisle while Elvis sings "Love Me Tender." The band was a very tight karaoke machine, and nothing says Vegas wedding like Elvis and a karaoke machine. But perhaps the most unforeseen part of the ceremony was this: Elvis himself. He looked deep into our eyes, his bearing more Obi-Wan Kenobi than pop star, and spoke of commitment and forgiveness and patience. He spoke of laughter. He kept the "I'm so proud she's my buttercup" jokes to a minimum, which might have disappointed me if I hadn't so completely fallen under the incandescent spell of the moment. He brought up the chapel's recipe for love, a sort of down-home version of 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast, and stressed the importance of kindness, friendship, and warmth in a marriage. My wife and I found ourselves nodding as if we were contestants on Squid Game and were hearing the rules for the first time. After the ceremony, Elvis serenaded us with "Can't Help Falling in Love" as we danced together. Much to my surprise, that dance was as affecting as our first dance at our real wedding. Suddenly, this silly renewal was giving me all the feels. Moreover, unlike at our actual nuptials, we knew what song we were dancing to. No one had at our wedding. Our first dance that day had been to the Ricky Lee Jones ballad, "We Belong Together." But it was played by a New York society band my mother-in-law liked, and they had no idea how to make a Ricky Lee Jones torch song work at a wedding. There are a thousand reasons why my lovely bride and I have been together since we were teenagers. Yes, flowers and love letters matter. The small, daily things like the romantic text or words with friends in bed. But we have always understood that the big, silly, romantic gestures matter too. There's a reason why they ground the very best rom-coms. It's why, over the years, my wife once surprised me when I was on a book tour, appearing out of nowhere when I was speaking in Memphis. Likewise, there is nothing more beautiful than your wife's eyes when they're wide with wonder because it's her birthday and somehow you've gotten 25 of her friends into your yard without her having her clue. I've actually accomplished this feat twice, which perhaps is our own recipe for love. Always think rom-com and always go big. There's a book that accompanies this article. It's The Princess of Las Vegas by Chris Bohajalian. And that last name is spelled Bohajalian. This book is $22 at Amazon and $27 at Bookshop. We're moving over now to lifestyle and the work and money section. How to save for retirement in the age of longevity. We're obsessed with staying healthy into old age, but can our bank accounts keep up? This article is by Rosie Hopegood. Welcome to the new age of retirement anxiety, in which we all fret about having enough money saved to finally hand in our notice. These days, people are living longer than their parents did, or at least they're planning to. That means that their retirement pot needs to last for years or even decades longer than it did for previous generations. Here's a sobering fact. 61% of Americans are more scared of running out of money in retirement than of dying. For Gen X, the early 40 to late 50-somethings who will be the next generation to retire, the fear is real, with 42% saying they believe they could outlive their savings. Here's what you can do now, whether you're at whatever your age, to keep that nest egg growing. Figure out your number. That is the amount you need in that nest egg to live comfortably from retirement until, well, you know. Most people don't know their numbers, says Tori Dunlap, author of The Financial Feminist and host of the podcast of the same name. Money is so anxiety-inducing for most people that it's easy to bury our heads in the sand, according to a recent survey by the National Institute on Retirement Security. 54% of Gen Xers have no idea how much money they need for retirement, and 64% worry they won't have enough saved. So, how much do you actually need? There's no easy or universal answer, only variables. Most experts suggest saving enough money to live on for 25 to 30 years. You don't know how long you're going to live and what your expenses are going to be or what the markets are going to be like, says Anne Ackerley, head of BlackRock's retirement group. That's why Bill Sharp, the Nobel laureate economist, says this is the hardest problem in finance to solve. But there are a few ways to estimate it. Ackerley recommends using a retirement spending calculator like BlackRock's LifePath tool, which calculates how your contributions today can translate into income in retirement. While Dunlap has a handy calculation, a general rule of thumb is to multiply your annual expenses by 25, she says. That means adding up everything from your mortgage, insurance premiums, car payments, and vacations to monthly groceries and manicures, even your morning macchiato. So if you spend $50,000 a year and multiply by 25, that's roughly $1.25 million you're going to need. If your number makes you break into a cold sweat, remember that the compound interest accrued over time will boost your bottom line considerably. To make sure you've come to a realistic figure, Ackerley notes that you can also use something called the 4% rule. You should be able to withdraw 4% of your retirement pot each year and still have it last 30 years. So, if you have $1 million saved, you could withdraw $40,000 a year to live on, topped off by your Social Security payouts, which we explain next. Fiercely protect your 401k. Once upon a time, you called it quits at 65, safe in the knowledge that you'd receive your pension. Traditionally, this entailed an employer giving you a set monthly sum based on your salary and years of service for life, or paying out a lump sum when you retire. In the 1980s, this changed. Defined benefit pensions were phased out, replaced by defined contribution plans, where workers pay into a fund, 401ks or IRAs, to save for old age. Most often this fund is invested, and many, but not all, employers will match your contributions up to a certain percentage in a 401k. The downside. Contribution plans put the onus of financial planning on the individual. You also take an associated risks with a pension. You'd receive the same amount even if the market tanked But this isn't the case with a 401k or an IRA. Plus, you need to proactively choose where you invest your money. Most of the time, you do this when you sign up, but sometimes people slip through the net. Dunlap tells the cautionary tale of an older lady who came to her after finding out her 401k had never been invested. She'd been saving part of her paycheck in her 401k for 35 years. But because she hadn't chosen an investment fund, it had accrued zero interest. She'd managed to save $300,000, but Dunlap notes that if she'd invested, the principal amount of money would probably have grown to over $2 million. Unfortunately, stories like this are common. I literally get messages from people in that position every other day, says Dunlap. The problem is that nobody explains this to you. To check on the status of your investments now, log into your account, or if you have one, call your benefits person at work. Dunlap and Ackerley agree that you should take advantage of your employer's 401k matching offer if you can. If they match up to 3% per paycheck, invest 3% per paycheck. That's free money, and we definitely want to take advantage of that, says Dunlap. And it goes without saying that starting early is key to that compound interest. Something invested over 40 years can become a meaningful amount. It's not about timing the market, it's about time in the market. Invest for the long haul. Rather than investing in individual stocks and shares, your 401k may offer the option for a target date fund, TDF, an investment account that focuses on somewhat riskier, potentially higher yielding stocks in the early years, before moving toward more conservative investments as the target date, aka retirement, approaches. I am a huge advocate, says Ackerley. I tell all my friends and family members, just invest in a TDF because it does it all for you. Investing isn't interesting to a lot of people, but with this fund, you can just set it and forget it. If you don't have an employer-assisted 401k, set up an IRA. This type of account is either tax-free, also known as a Roth IRA, in which you save after-tax dollars, or tax-deferred. You can invest your pre-tax salary, but must pay tax when you make withdrawals in retirement, depending on what you choose. If you're lucky enough to max out your 401k contributions, $23,000 a year under age 50, $30,500 thereafter, you can also set up an IRA and invest $7,000 a year or $8,000 a year post 50. There's no limit to the number of IRAs you can have, as long as your annual contributions stay within the limit. Play catch up. On average, Gen Xers have just $108,600 in their retirement pots. If you're one of the 40% of Americans who say that your retirement plan has derailed and you don't know how to get it back on track, there's still plenty you can do. As noted above, the year you turn 50, you can increase your 401k contributions by $7,500, bringing your total annual allowance to $30,500. The money is tax-deferred, meaning you'll also slash your tax bill. Beyond that, Dunlap notes that you either need to make more money or need to spend less. If spending less in the current economic climate seems tough, Dunlap recommends finding ways to make more. This means negotiating your salary or switching jobs if you're being undercompensated. It means taking full advantage of every single benefit your employer offers. And if you have the ability to, taking on a side hustle or diversifying your income. Finally, Dunlap warns against risky or potentially scammy investments as retirement nears. It's very easy to allow this feeling of desperation to creep in when you realize you don't have enough saved, she says. If you're over 50, you're going to start feeling like you need to make up for lost time. And there are people who are going to prey on that. Don't seek out higher risk investments. Obscure cryptocurrencies you've never heard of, seemingly too good to be true real estate investments in foreign countries, without understanding the consequences. If your gut is telling you not to do something, it's probably right, she says. Stay invested. Once you hit 59.5 years old, you can make penalty-free withdrawals from your 401k. Before that, you can make a hardship withdrawal if money is tight. But Ackerley strongly advises against it. It's a pretty devastating system because once you do that, you aren't able to contribute again for 6 months, she says. People get busy and forget to start saving again. Hardship withdrawals don't come with a penalty, but you'll pay income tax on whatever you withdraw. Last year, hardship withdrawals hit a record high, with the highest number among people of color. Ackerley notes that women are also more likely to make withdrawals than men. Gender pay gap, meet the gender savings gap. The problem for many of us, she notes, is a lack of access to emergency funds. There's currently a lot of focus on encouraging people to have a pool of money that can help them through these financial hard times, she says. This is a good thing because taking money out of the market is fairly devastating to your long-term security. Vote wisely. For better or worse, how much money you have in retirement isn't completely within your control. I would argue that personal finances are 20% about your own choices and 80% your circumstances. The system you exist in and how that impacts you, says Dunlap. For instance, with almost 45% of Americans over 65 relying solely on Medicare for health care coverage, it's important to remember that both Medicare and Social Security are likely to be vital to your financial well-being during your golden years. Even though the trust funds that the Social Security Administration relies on to pay benefits is predicted to run out by 2035 without action from Congress. Voting isn't just a civic duty. It's also a financial investment in your future. Regardless of age, you want to vote for the kind of legislators that take care of you and your family, says Dunlap. This goes beyond who is in the White House, she notes. Your local government is going to have a lot more of a day-to-day impact on your money than who is getting elected president. Voting is a huge part of this. So, how do you know whom to vote for? Per Dunlap, it's vital to choose candidates who are committed to addressing issues like the gender wage gap, women's reproductive rights, and advocating for more affordable or debt-free college options. If you're considering a candidate, she recommends asking yourself these questions. Are they committed to feminism and equal rights for women? Do they support women, mothers, and people of color? If you're overwhelmed right now, it's okay. Just breathe, tackle things one at a time, and remember that final word from Ackerley. Don't be afraid to talk about money. Get those matching 401k contributions if you can. Save early. Stay invested. Over in culture and news, Ryan Reynolds shares the secret to his and Blake Lively's long-lasting Hollywood marriage. This article is by Alyssa Bailey. Blake Lively and Ryan Reynolds have accomplished a real feat in and out of Hollywood. 10 years of marriage. Reynolds spoke to People about how their relationship has endured while discussing his close 17-year-long friendship with Hugh Jackman in a joint interview. I think the secret sauce to a long-lasting Hollywood friendship is not too dissimilar to having a partner or a marriage, Reynolds began, telling Jackman. I am genuinely rooting for you all the time. I want you to win. It's the same way I feel about Blake. As I'm rooting for her, I know she's rooting for me, and it's why we're so connected. Of course, this isn't the first time Reynolds has spoken about what makes his marriage work. In fact, he has spoken about the importance of his friendship with Lively multiple times over the years. He told Entertainment Tonight in November 2021, "We don't take each other too seriously, but we're also friends. Falling in love is great, but do you like each other? That's kind of the question you gotta ask yourself, you know, going into it. We've always liked each other. We grow together, we learn from each other, so yeah, I'm lucky to have a buddy in that." Lively and Reynolds actually started as friends before they dated, following their co-starring gigs on 2011's Green Lantern. Reynolds recounted their When Harry Met Sally beginnings on Entertainment Weekly's Sirius XM radio show in February 2016. "I remember it was funny because for about a year after Green Lantern had come and gone and all that stuff, we were both singled," Reynolds said. "We went on a double date with, well, she was on a date with another guy, and I was on a date with another girl, and that was the most awkward date from their perspective, probably, because we were just like fireworks coming across. Yeah, it was like this first weird date, but we were buddies for a long time. I think it's the best way to have a relationship, to start as friends." Still in culture and news, Kelly Clarkson Show fans can't get over how Simu Liu called out the host on the air. The Atlas star wasn't afraid to speak his mind about Clarkson's musical covers. This article is by Adriana Friedman. "It's not every day Kelly Clarkson gets called out on her own show, but leave it to Simu Liu to share his honest thoughts on her vocals. Simu was a guest on the Kelly Clarkson Show on May 22nd, promoting his Netflix movie Atlas. As he sat down for an interview with Clarkson, the two got to discussing music and Clarkson's song covers as part of her opening Kellyoka segment. When Clarkson joked how she must be annoying with the plethora of tunes she sung throughout 5 seasons of hosting the NBC daytime show, Liu couldn't help but be sassy about how amazing she is as a singer. "I sing a lot. I'm like annoying," Clarkson told Liu in a clip posted on YouTube. "I'm like a walking musical." "You are annoying, in that you're annoyingly talented and you do the best covers, and you make it so that the artists can never sing the song ever again," Liu exasperately responded as Clarkson bent over laughing. "They're so good." When a video of the hilarious exchange eventually wound up on Instagram, fans immediately sided with Liu and agreed with his blunt thoughts about Clarkson's extraordinary musical covers. "I love that even celebrities know about Kelly covering songs," one person commented. Kelly, clapping after the "you are annoying" comment, a different follower added, "Kelly, wondering how she won Idol, has me, #HumblebeeQueen," a third wrote. If Liu's unfiltered thoughts about Clarkson's music prove anything, it's that no one can deny just how great she is as an artist. As for Liu's love of music, fans may remember he released an EP titled Anxious Avoidant in November 2023. He also released music videos for his songs Don't and Warm. In culture and news, Kensington Palace gives a rare update on Princess Kate's return to work status. The Princess of Wales has been out of commission since January as she undergoes treatment for cancer. This article is by Chelsea Sanchez. "We'll have to wait a while to see the Princess of Wales back on Buckingham Palace's famous balcony." Kensington Palace confirmed that Princess Kate will not join the royal family to attend the June 8 rehearsal for this year's Trooping the Colour, a ceremonial event held annually to celebrate the birthday of the current British monarch. Her attendance at the June 15 event has yet to be confirmed. At the ceremony, Kate typically serves as the inspecting officer at the traditional colonel's review, but this year that role will instead go to Lieutenant General James Bucknell, KCB CBE People reports. The rare update on Kate's return to work status comes as the Royal undergoes preventative chemotherapy to treat her cancer, a condition she revealed in a personal video message on March 22nd. But Kate had been missing in action for months prior to her announcement, having paused her royal duties as she recovered from an abdominal surgery in January per the palace. She last carried out an official public engagement on December 25th, when she participated in the royal family's traditional walk to Christmas morning church service on the Sandringham estate. Although she hasn't embarked on official engagement since, Kate was last publicly spotted in March. At the time, a video captured her leaving a Windsor farm shop with husband Prince William at her side. And earlier this week, some publications reported that Kate had been seen running errands with her family, although no photos or videos of that outing have been published. The princess will return to official duties when she is cleared to do so by her medical team, a source told Harper's Bazaar in March. She is in good spirits and is focused on making a full recovery. Meanwhile, the source said, William will continue to balance supporting his wife and family and maintaining his official duties as he has done since the start of the year. So here is a suggested gift for a teacher. They are Best Custom Gift Custom Teacher Bobbleheads. They're $137 at bobblegifts.com. Capture the likeness of your favorite teacher with a custom bobblehead personalized to resemble them. This handcrafted figurine makes a funny yet thoughtful appreciation gift for your favorite educator. It's sure to take pride of place on their desk. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.